At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion. It's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Let's talk.
John Brown. Hope I get old before I die. I didn't read that wrong. It's Why Rock Stars Never Retire from the best-selling author of Abbey Road. We've had him on the show before. It's an interesting one because pop music was always supposed to be flash in the pan, according to its critics, but they are still here. The names of Pink Floyd, Bruce Springsteen, and Paul McCartney have remained in the ever-changing music game. Delighted to say that joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, I should imagine, is the author. Welcome back to the show, David Hepworth. David, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Pop music wasn't supposed to live this long, was it? So I suppose a lot of people are thinking, why are they still out there? Why are they still doing it?
Well, I suppose, you know, for the same reasons the rest of us, you know, they kind of like doing what they do, and they find themselves in the incredibly fortunate position that there are people who will still pay to see and hear them doing what they do, you know, which nobody expected would go on this long. You know, famously, when the Beatles were asked during Beatlemania what they were going to do when it all finished, because everybody assumed it would all finish, and John and Paul said they would write songs for other people, and Ringo said he might have a chain of hairdressers, you know, which was big thinking really at the time, because that's kind of what people did in those days. You know, that's what footballers did, and you know, they took on pubs or they ran sports shops. That's what they did. There was no sense that he, you know, all these years later, he would be Sir Ringo Starr. And arguably, I would say, if anything, more famous now than he was all those years ago, because there's nobody in the world who doesn't know who Ringo Starr is nowadays, because successive generations have become familiar with these names, you know. So far from being a flash in the pan, they find themselves in they're a stock that everybody wants to buy, I suppose. And what they're selling is their uniqueness. You know, if you want Pink Floyd or you want Paul McCartney or whatever, there's nothing like it. You can't move to the next one along the shelf, you know, and get it slightly cheaper. It's Paul McCartney, it's Mick Jagger, it's Bruce Springsteen. You know, they are kind of brand names, aren't they? And what they're purveying, nobody else is purveying. And people seem increasingly happy to, you know, to pay for it.
Well, the thing is, I mean, a lot of people are resampling this stuff as well. You know, mentioning a riff from a Beatles song or a Rolling Stones song gets replayed. I mean, there was a famously, wasn't it Rihanna and what's his name, the crazy one? I've gone out. The very famous, who was married to a Kardashian. Anyway, they did a song. It was Rihanna and I can't remember his name, and Paul McCartney. And somebody said, "Isn't it great that Rihanna and this guy are giving this unknown Paul McCartney, because the generation whatever didn't know who he was."
Well, you know, you've also had the odd situation of things like Fleetwood Mac have found an entirely new audience via TikTok, you know, over the last few years. You know, there's somebody just picking up one of their tunes on some kind of skateboarding clip or something, you know, and they have been, oddly enough, beneficiaries of the kind of digital online revolution, you know, which you wouldn't have thought had been the case. But, you know, I think, you know, when the internet came along, if we can still call it that,
yes,
which is whatever, 24 years ago or whatever, and the great transformation came, that meant that the names of the 60s and 70s and 80s need never disappear, because in the world of the internet, nobody disappears. You can go and find out if you want to find out some group that you've followed when you were 16 years old many years ago. Go and look on Google. Yeah. They will, I guarantee, still be there in some shape or form, and they will be playing probably somewhere tonight. You know, because all that technology facilitated people keeping in touch with their fans and also contacting newer generations who come along all the time. Because, you know, anybody who's got children knows that that they probably hear more music than you or I ever heard when we were growing up. But what they don't have is any sense of the chronology of music. They don't have any sense of the story. You know, it's loads of stuff. And, you know, did Simon and Garfunkel come before Graceland? Well, they wouldn't know, probably. You know, it's just they've got access to all that material. It's just a fact of life.
It's interesting because if you wanted to find a band in the old days, you had to go to the record store. So if there was a band that you like and it wasn't being stocked in your record store, they were gone forever. If you wanted to find the back catalogue of Thomas Dolby or Nick Kershaw or whatever, I mean, or if the guy behind the desk in the record store didn't know, then you were scuppered.
Yeah, absolutely. And I used to work in the 70s. I worked in what was then the biggest record shop in the world, which was HMV in Oxford Street. And let me tell you, all the catalogue information that we had was all held in a little card index on the counter that was filled in pencil by members of staff when new things came out. So if it wasn't the card index, you had to rely on somebody behind the counter having a long enough memory to be able to tell you something about it. Whereas nowadays, everything is at the end of a retrieval system of some kind, you know, which is, it's fantastic in a way, you know.
Yeah, I just remembered it was Kanye West who was doing the thing with Rihanna and Paul McCartney. But the music business has changed because of that, their internet thing. And it's interesting that you talk about their original, you can't move along and get one like it in the shelf next to it, because now big business is buying back catalogues of a Bob Dylan, of a Bowie, of a whoever. And so it's an investment. And again, this has gone to prove that the people who got together basically as a skiffle band in the 50s are now, even though they may have last performed live with the original act at some point in the 60s or 70s, they are still caning in and getting huge amounts of cash and reaching new audiences because of the commercial possibilities that people are putting this music out via.
Well, there's certainly huge amounts of cash being exchanged for old catalogues. I don't think it's always the case that the bands are the owners of those old catalogues. You know, I think it depend on the deals that people did in the first place and how much acumen they show, you know. And we've certainly been through a bubble in the last few years where institutions have come along signing checks for enormous sums of money, which nobody is daft enough to turn down, you know, because they think, well, this might be my only opportunity. There's also the fact that you're better off dividing it amongst your descendants, your children or whatever, while you're here, than leaving it to them to scrap about it afterwards, after you've gone, which of course has happened in many cases, you know, like many of the cases where you see people being taken to court over plagiarism. It's usually on behalf of some estate and some kind of ambulance chasing lawyer who's advising some nephew of somebody who half wrote the song or something about 50 years ago. I don't think he's always the most deserving beneficiary of these things, you know, but that's just the way it goes.
I've had a thought about this because, and you know, I do occasionally think and do some prep before my interviews, but this whole situation of people saying, oh, well, you know, people like Jagger and McCartney, they shouldn't be on stage because they're too old, okay? But when you think about the British blues explosion that happened in the 60s and unsuspecting London, you know, through various things and John Mayall and all that, and Alex's Corner and that, and then we export it back to the Americans to go, who, you know, where do these tracks come? And it's like, it's from your own front yard. But if you think about the great names of blues and the great names of jazz who influenced them, they weren't flash in the pants. You know, I mean, Muddy Waters certainly didn't stop playing. Chuck Berry didn't stop playing. They were just seen as older bluesmen, which is kind of what, you know, a Jagger, a Richards was aspiring to.
I suppose so. Oddly enough, the kind of blues names that inspired Mick Jagger and Keith Richards didn't live that long, because they usually lived really unfortunate lives of one kind or another. And there usually been a 20-year period in the middle when nobody was interested in them at all. And they were kind of rediscovered in their 60s and sent out on stage, you know. But, you know, what drives, you know, the Rolling Stones or Paul McCartney or whatever, apart from the money, and clearly the money's part of it. But, you know, if you could go out on stage at, you know, how old is Keith Richards? I think he's 80 now, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Jagger just turned 80, so yeah.
Jagger's 82, I think.
That's right. That's right.
McCartney's 82. Sorry, I got that wrong. Anyway, yeah. If you were Keith Richards at the age of 80, tonight, well, they're not touring at the moment, you know, up until a couple of weeks ago they were, you can go on stage and hit some approximation of the original chords at the opening of Honky Tonk Women. And in front of 60,000 people who are just going to bathe you in a wave of affection and approbation, because you're an 80-year-old bloke, why the hell wouldn't you do it? There's nobody on God's earth who wouldn't do it. You know what I mean? And if you've tasted that in life, and you can continue to taste it, you will. Mm. You know, the interesting contrast is with footballers. You know, the footballers, I had read an interview with Gary Lineker recently, where he said that he hadn't kicked a ball since he'd retired at the age of 35. And I thought that's sad, really. That makes me want to weep, you know. There's one thing that you're brilliant at. You stop doing it totally. Whereas these guys can keep doing it. And there's nobody else that can keep doing it. Actors can't keep going that long, really. You know what I mean? And there are people that revere novelists that long, you know, because what they like about seeing their old favourites is there's the person who used to look down from my bedroom wall at the age of 14, you know, from a poster, and look, there they are. They're still there, you know. And so we find that hugely, hugely moving thing. That's why we go.
But not only that, because I've often said this, music is a time machine. Because you hear the opening chords of a certain bit of music and it will take you back to exactly where you were, what you were feeling, who you were dating, what awful fashions you were wearing, you know, where the chip shop was, in an instance. I mean, if I listen to, you know, the opening bars from Tears for Fears' Songs of the Big Chair, I'm suddenly, you know, I've got the 80s, I've got hair, I've got 80s hair, I've got shoulder pads, and I'm running across a garden in southern Spain in 1985.
But you've also, the other factor is, I think all pop music, when it gets old, begins to sound poignant. You know, it becomes kind of moving because of those things you've talked about, you know, because it is taking you back and you're thinking about all the events, everything that's elapsed in between, you know, the record being made and you hearing it now. You know, all pop music eventually sounds like My Way, you know. It all does, you know. That's why people play it at funerals. You know, it becomes tear jerking in that context, doesn't it?
It's the soundtrack to your life, isn't it? If everybody's life's got a personal soundtrack, and then so certain songs are that.
Yeah. And so. This one of the interesting things is that people retain their fascination with, you know, the musicians of their youth, but they don't desperately, in most cases, they don't desperately want to hear them play anything new.
No.
Want to hear. That's the odd thing, which, you know, to the great chagrin of the performer very often, you know, because they want to make a new record to feel that they're in the game and they're still current and so forth. But, you know, nothing is more likely to create, you know, to trigger a stampede to the bar than the words, we're now going to play three songs from our new album, you know?
Yes. Yes, you indeed. Know,
there's very few people who have worked out how to do that, you know. But you know, eventually, I think also as the prices of going to big gigs, you know, increase, and you know, the book starts with Live Aid.
Yeah.
And at the time of Live Aid, you know, in 1985, people thought it was a bit much to pay £25 to get, you know. And they thought, well, that's all right. Half of it's going to charity. That's fair enough. You know, whereas now, you know, there is no limits to what people,
yes,
people will spend. But if people are spending a lot of money, the kind of the power game switches at a show. And so the acts are kind of duty bound to perform what the audience want to hear rather than this is my new album and, you know, Keith's going to do one of his own, not somebody's going to do special solo.
Well, it's gone, you know, full Spinal Tap and the Jazz Odyssey thing, but you are on about, because, you know, it's the way that music makes its money now is from live gigging because of the way that the industry has changed. But you mentioned Live Aid. Is that like a watershed? Because suddenly these artists suddenly realize they still got the buzz, that connection between a huge audience and a live performance. Because a lot of them hadn't done. I mean, Queen had been written off at this point, and that was the one that kick-started.
They've been written off in Britain. I don't think they've been written off everywhere by any means. But, you know, I think what happened to Live Aid is that, you know, there was a huge TV audience watching at home who all sat there. And the key thing about Live Aid, and I know this because I was there, is the sun shone. Mm. That's the key thing. Had it rained, it would not have been on BBC One. It would not have been the big deal, you know. Whereas sunshine, blue sky, and it looked idyllic. And so, and also the audience was not made up of the usual partisan people. It was people who'd come to see and hear loads of things. And therefore, they were a very kind of accepting audience. And so the notion of these people kind of clapping their hands above their head to Queen's Radio Gaga or whatever was immensely attractive to people who had never been to a big show like that. And they thought, next time there is one of those things, I'm going to go, you know. And, you know, the audience for live rock and roll in the late 80s was kind of, I don't know, it was between the ages of 14 and 30 or something like that. Nowadays, it's between the ages of 8 and 80. You know, it's a completely different thing. It's the mainstream of popular entertainment. It didn't used to be at all.
And also it's become an experience. I mean, a friend of mine went to see the most famous woman in the world, Taylor Swift, and she said it was a long show. There were 80 costume changes. She shot out of here, there and everywhere. People have flown over from the States to see it because it was cheaper to see it at Wembley. But she said, you know, if you weren't a fan before, you certainly were at the end of it because it was it used to a point where, you know, the artist would shuffle on, not wanting to be there, not doing anything in front of the mic and get off after about, you know, just under the hour mark. Now you've got 4-hour shows, you know, exploding dancing girls. I mean, just the whole, I mean, it makes Rammstein look like a Cub firework display.
Well, it has to be 4 hours because you've charged a fortune from it. Mm. You know, that's the kind of transaction. I'd say what's the key difference with gigs nowadays, and you can hear it if you go back and listen to live albums from, you know, 40, 50 years ago. Bands used to come on stage to polite applause, you know, and it was now prove it to me, you know, now impress me. Nowadays, every band comes on stage to hysterical approbation. Because if you've paid that amount of money, you're sold already. You know, it's up to them to kind of justify it, you know, beyond that. And so there's a kind of, and it's also, you know, I think one of the things I write about in the book is the advent of the age of whooping. You know, there was a time when people didn't whoop. People now whoop at everything. You know, it's kind of learned response. And the other thing, and it's my youngest daughter pointed out this to me too. Yeah, she went to Glastonbury a year before last, I think. And she came back and said, how was it? She says, it's so well organized. And I thought, my God, the world's changed.
Yeah.
Woodstock was chaos. I mean, people died, you know, it was just terrible. And whereas nowadays, it's you can plug in your hair straighteners and all that kind of thing. And I say, well, why do people go to Glastonbury? Why do people pay however much they pay? It was a lot of money. And she said to me, looked at me like I'm a fool. She said, well, Instagram is the reason people do these things.
Instagram.
I think it's true.
Right.
You know, if you look at the hysteria around Oasis tickets in the UK in the last couple of weeks, nothing explains that other than FOMO is not kind of just a cute line in a lifestyle piece. It's a fact of life. People nowadays dread missing out on anything, you know, big events, big sporting events, big music events, anything like that. And they will pay. They will pay to be assured that they're not missing out. The other thing is they're buying tickets in a way that nobody ever did in the past. Yeah. Not only are they paying a lot of money for them, they're buying them a year in advance. Nobody ever did that. Nobody would ever in 1985 say, I'll tell you what, give me 100 quid and I'll be back here in a year's time. They said, you'll be daft. No, you won't.
Well, yeah, you used to go to the Brixton Academy and there'd be guys that say, buy, sell tickets. You know, the tarots would be going, buy, sell any tickets. I mean, that was part of the thing, wasn't it? If you didn't have a ticket to a gig, you would go down to the academy or wherever and you'd find one.
Yeah, I didn't even have to buy them off touts a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You know, people, loads of the legendary gigs that people talk about. You know, I was talking to somebody when I wrote my book about 1971, you know, and a book about rock stars. David Bowie did his last Ziggy Stardust show at Hammersmith Odeon.
Yeah.
I was talking to a guy who went, he says, well, a load of us just bunked off school and went down there. I said, how do you get tickets? I just bought them at the box office. You know, the notion that you can buy a thing at the box office. But whereas people nowadays assume that you can never buy anything at the box office, which I don't think is true. I think you can, actually. But, you know, we are seized with the panic to spend money, to book early. And, you know, when those Oasis shows take place, there will not be a single person going to those shows, literally not a single person who will not take a photograph of themselves at the show and post it on Instagram.
Yes.
There literally won't be one. And that will be as much to do with how they interrogate their value for money as anything Oasis do. You know what I mean? It's a kind of social, it's a social thing. It's an event featuring me. Oh, and there's this group as well.
You can imagine it, can't you? The victory in Europe celebrations during the Instagram age. You know, it would have been, you know, oh, by the way, we've just defeated the Nazis, but in the meantime, here's a picture of me snogging a girl.
Absolutely. Everybody would have done that. You know, picture with the GI or whatever it was in Paris. I can't remember.
but seriously, folks, I mean, it's a bloody good point that. But also, these acts, you think about the Beatles, you think about Springsteen. The Beatles, obviously, rock and roll band, played in Hamburg, whatever shows a day. Springsteen, legendary, hardworking man on tour. They're going to do this until they literally fall off the edge of stage because that's all they know.
Well, also, why would you not? I mean, how much fun is that? You know, and also, let's not forget they're musicians, and musicians only want to do one thing, which is play music. That's what they want to do. And if you can play at a level like that and in front of adoring crowds, you know, I can't see any reason why you would stop. You know, I don't think any of them are going to announce that they're stopping. They may just slowly withdraw from it because it'll probably be ill health or something like that. But, you know, some people, slightly earlier people, you know, kept going. Glenn Campbell writes about it in the book, you know, his last tour while he was suffering from Alzheimer's, you know. Tony Bennett was doing the same thing. You know, and Tony Bennett used to occasionally get, you know, occasionally ill at ease backstage, you know, anxious or whatever. And then he would hear the sound of the PA announcer saying, ladies and gentlemen, the voice of I left my heart in San Francisco, and his eyes would just light up and he'd just make his way towards the stage because that's what he did.
Yeah.
And it is, a thing that you can kind of do with muscle memory to a certain extent. You know what I mean?
And of course, with the event of holograms and ABBA doing their thing and Elvis doing their thing, they will be with us forever performing at their higher peak.
Well, I don't know how that's going to work, because I've thought long and hard about who else could work in the ABBA way. And I've struggled to think of anybody, really.
Oh, the Pistols. Come on, that'd be fun.
It just won't work in the same way. ABBA have a unique place in our heart. And also, I do think the enduring appeal of ABBA is connected with the fact that they're all with us. Yeah. You know, we know they're all there. You know, so that keeps us... They're a happy memory.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than going, you know, it looked just like John, for example, if you did a Beatles one.
Yeah. I don't know. It remains to be seen whether anything will work the same way, because all those really top acts, you know, the ABBA and the Beatles, and there aren't many others, they are unique. You know, there's nobody like them at all. You can't trade down from the Rolling Stones to somebody a bit like the Rolling Stones. There isn't such a thing, you know. And it's like, you know, I've said to my own children when Bruce Springsteen, I said, go see Bruce Springsteen, because when he stops doing what he's doing, there will be nobody in the world doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
There simply won't be, because it's a development of him. You know what I mean? So it's a living autobiography musically. And it's, you know, it sets out to be things that nobody else sets out to be, you know? So these greats, you know, they're unique cases, you know, even Bob Dylan in his odd, erratic way. It's Bob Dylan, for crying out loud. Yeah. There's nobody like Brooklyn.
He's there. Like exactly.
Dylan. I mean, absolutely.
People, yeah. He played down in my part of the world, down in southern Spain, and somebody said, I'm going to go and see him. And I said, you could just, it was a bit, you know, the stage was backing onto a beach. I said, you can just sit on the beach for free and listen to him. He said, no, but I want to see Dylan. This is what it sounds like. I want to see him.
Well, this is great truth about rock stars, as I pointed out in my book about rock stars. The thing we're most interested in doing with rock stars is not listening to them play, not listen to them talk. We want to look at them. We really want to look at them. That's what you'd most like. You'd like to be in a room with Keith Richards where he didn't know you were there, and you just sat there and you looked at him, and you looked at his shoes, and you looked at his earrings, and all, and you looked at how he talked to people. That's what fascinates us about rock stars. You know,
never thought that before, but you're spot on. I'm going to run out of time, David. The book is called Hope I Get Old Before I Die, Why Rock Stars Never Retire. It's by David Hepworth. David, where can people find you on that big, bad internet thing?
Oh, I suppose the best place to find me is on Instagram, where I'm under D. Hepworth.
And will you be FOMOing yourself during the Oasis scramble?
No, I stayed well out of that. I was never a big fan at all, so I shan't be revisiting that.
Marvellous. The book is called Hope I Die Before I Get Old. David Hepworth, thank you so much again for your time today.
Thank you.